this chaos agenda. So that's why one of the main messages that's got to come out from this is our internal security forces have got to pull their socks up, because there is a chaos agenda out there. There are organisations like the fascist group, the Order of Nine Angles, who are trying to push this, which are still not outlawed in Britain, even though it was invented in Britain. So they need to pull their socks up and make sure these sorts of ways of completely destroying and destabilising a society, the sort of thing that people like Hezbollah and the Iranian government have having to put out, are kept well out of the rest of the world. It has to be contained, but it looks to me like it's starting to spread.
So Tony, let me just get this right. So when I asked the question, who benefits from the killing of Charlie Kirk, to William, you believe that the Israeli regime benefits from this assassination? Is that what you're saying?
I think quite possibly, because he was a very powerful influencer in the United States. As I said, he was a leader of young people. And so what was clearly going on was he was starting to be very negative towards the Israeli genocide. He's refusing funding from Netanyahu as well, which the Grey Zone has publicised. And it's quite clear he was starting to veer away. He was his own man, and he decided that what Netanyahu was doing was enough. He's even questioning whether the Israeli army was stood down on October the 7th. These sorts of things the Israelis will not want to hear at all from someone who's supposed to be supported and someone who in the
All right,
the
stay
past,
with me, Tony. Stay with me, Tony. Let me get William back in on this discussion. Stay with me, Tony.
Please.
Stay with me. Let me get William back in on this. Stay with me, Tony. One second. Let me give you equal time here to William. Stay with me. I know you're very adamant about this, but I mean, William, your thoughts. I mean, there are reports that 1 in 15 Americans now are witnessing or have witnessed mass shootings. First of all, I want to look at this. I mean, what does this mean to the American psyche? And why are we seeing such an increase in polarization in that country?
Well, obviously, there has been really a lack of policy that people feel has benefited the nation over the probably the last 10, 15, maybe 20 years. The American economy, for instance, has gone from bad to worse under the so-called free market ideology that has been practiced over the last few decades. People who 20 years ago, one father of a family could support large families of six or seven children on one job. Today, that is not the case. The shift everybody knows between rich and poor, the rich have gotten richer and the poor are poorer. The conditions of life within the United States are abysmal. Even if you compare it with going to Russia today or going to China, even going to China today in particular, you see the differences in, you know, the communication systems, the infrastructure is all going to really to hell in a handbasket. And nobody has had the means of actually changing that, which is partially the reason for an outsider like Donald Trump being elected with popular support from the American population, who realized that we were going in the wrong direction. Now, he has not been able successfully to turn that around. And it's my opinion that he's not going to be able to do that in with his present mode of tariff threats either, but it is a possibility of doing something with this with the right policy. But the fact that that has not been done has created this increasing diversity, increasing split between sections of the population that we saw in the last election or in the last three elections, and which we are seeing today on the streets in the rising violence. This is something that I would compare it to the reaction after 9/11, where people were all of a sudden shocked, wondering what is going on here. That can lead to some elements of craziness if people are not thinking rationally. But if they are thinking rationally, what they would do is, as the Utah governor quite clearly stated, and I think this is the feeling of many politicians, even those who are infected with the zeal for their own political lines, they realize that the country somehow has got to come back to some form of normalcy, that is away from this wave of violence are threatening your opponents to their with their lives in the political matters. And I'm hopeful that we will be able to use this tragedy, which everybody has been focused on, even those who were supporters of Charlie Kirk, as well as those who were opponents of Charlie Kirk, they also will be affected. They also know that if this type of violence goes on in the United States, they also can be threatened, of whether they're on the left or on the right. And I think that's what you have to use to try and get a focus, and a lot of this will depend on the attitude of the president and the administration in dealing with this crisis. But the task remains at this point that we have got to get away from this continual, very bitter, very angry, and often very violent rivalry in the country, and try and find common interests in which both parties and people from different points of view can come together for the common good.
All right, well, Tony, some political experts are saying that in reality, the under 40 crowd on both the right and left in the U.S. had been coming together on an increasingly anti-war, pro-Palestine agenda, and that this killing actually benefits those who want to keep the people divided. Your thoughts about that?
Well, I'm not sure what effect the killing will have, but yes, that's quite right. As the atrocities go on and on and on from the land of Palestine, so more and more people are starting to think, when is this going to end? And they're starting to realize that Netanyahu is playing a bit of a game with the world for his own political survival, and that obviously hundreds of thousands of people, it now looks like, you know, it's maybe well be into the hundreds of thousands, are going to die. And certainly millions are suffering immediately in Gaza because of this one man's political career, and the world seems utterly impotent. So these facts, after an amount of time, do finally filter through. But when it comes to the sort of violence that killed Charlie, we have to really point the finger, I think, at the mainstream press and also at the social media. We just had a big racist rally with Tommy Robinson in London this weekend, and who should pop up to encourage him? Elon Musk, the owner of Twitter, what is now Twitter, he calls it X, doesn't he? So he's there egging on the racists, saying, oh, isn't it terrible? He's trying his best to divide the country in Britain, and of course he does a similar sort of thing in the United States. So these people are actually looking at profits coming from their organ. Obviously, they would like to use it for influence too, but they make money. The more people use the social media platforms, and so this is why I think they try and create these massive divisions. You get everybody on there and everybody fighting each other, and the more clicks that people do, the more money Mr. Musk will make. And so this is, I mean, they're virtually non-regulated, aren't they? In fact, nobody's even allowed to know about the algorithms that they use. So somebody who's calling for peace, like I do, for example, will find many of their posts, you can't view it. It says this is sensitive content. This is difficult. So what I'm saying is the mass media and the social media have caused this sort of situation where all sorts of rumours, smears can go 10 times around the world, have billions of clicks before the truth gets out.
All right. Well, William, some experts say that the powers that be want to keep the masses divided so people can make sure that the masses never unite and basically turn their attention against the billionaires that, of course, one of them, Tony, was just speaking about. Is this a divide and conquer type of situation, trying to keep the people from being united? And overall, with this environment, where do you think the U.S. is headed?
Well, it's absolutely the case that this is being used, the conflict, the rivalries, the heated debates are always a means of keeping people divided against what is their common interest. But I think that the ultimate result of this may not be, I don't think, in favor of the country of Israel. Look, Charlie, as the former speaker pointed out, was moving against the genocide in Palestine, talking about it to people who generally consider themselves on the right, And, of course, if we look at all the demonstrations that are happening at the universities, these are people who generally are trending toward the left. I wouldn't say that they're all leftists. People are who are in the middle of the road are also upset about this whole situation. It's something that we haven't seen since the Second World War, of an entire, you know, group of people, entire nation, really, being decimated or threatened with decimation by a single power. And I think what may very well happen out of this, to the extent that people do not use this as a cudgel against their political opponents, which maybe even the administration, if they would move in that direction, would be a very bad move. But I think there is a possibility of using this, and even using Charlie's own words on this, to unite those elements who understand, one, that the country is moving in the wrong direction, and two, that what's going on internationally, in the Middle East in particular, in this genocide in Palestine, and also the war in Ukraine, which is also being fomented by those same political elites who realize that the world's population, even in the country, in the NATO countries, are being opposed to this war. They want that those people divided, okay, in order for the policy to go through. I think there's a possibility that we can use this in a positive way to move forward and bring together.
And on that note, I thank both of you. I'm out of time, but I appreciate you, Tony Gosling, historian and investigative journalist out of Bristol, being with me, and also William Jones, political analyst out of Leesburg, being with us. And thank you for staying with us right here in the spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You are listening to the program Bridge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mahdi, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdu wa thana' lillahi rabbil alameen. Wa salatu wa salam ala ashraf al-anbiya wal-mursaleen. Habib qulubana wa tabib nufusana abil qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad wa ala al-baytih al-tayyibin al-tahirin. Respected brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum. This is an honor and a blessing for me to be spending the next few minutes, inshallah, on the words of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam in the format of supplication in the book Sahifa Sajjadi in this program. We've been talking about the 18th dua of Sahifa Sajjadi, which is titled as إِذَا دُفَعَ عَنْهُمَا يَحْذَرْ أَوْ عُجِّلَ لَهُ مَطْلَبَهُ. When perils... Right, when perils were repelled or requests quickly granted to him, Imam Sajjad would suggest to us to recite this dua and contemplate in the phrases of this dua. In fact, every day, on daily basis, we get to those moments where something that is unwanted, that is harmful for us, that we think it is not something that we really want, we do not prefer it. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala repels them from us every day, on daily basis, right? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala saves you from accidents, saves you from loss, saves you from catastrophes that can start, saves you from fitnas that go on daily basis of life. And there are moments where you can get an access or gain an access to whatever that is pleasant to you, something that you've been dreaming for, something that you really wished it to be the way that you have imagined. In those moments, which are, I would say, decisive moments of life, there you will end up falling to one side or the other. Imam Sajjad alayhi salam teaches us a dua to be recited. Let's take a quick break, and inshallah we'll be back.
A path to salvation. A way to connect the two worlds.
A bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifatu Sajjadiyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Respected brothers and sisters, the dua that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam teaches us to be recited in the moments where we are either saved from a calamity, from a catastrophe, from something that we do not want, it seems to be unpleasant or harmful for us, or in the moments where we have achieved something that we've been wishing for a long time. In the final portion of that dua, in the 18th dua of Sahifa Sajjadiyah, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam says, فَغَيْرُ كَثِيرٍ مَعَقَبَتُهُ الْفَنَاءُ وَغَيْرُ قَلِيلٍ مَعَقَبَتُهُ الْبَقَاءُ وَصَلَّى عَلَى مُحَمَّدٍ وَآلِهِ. Right? I'm asking for that which ends in annihilation is not great. I want myself to understand that. And that which ends in subsistence is not little. Right? And bless Muhammad and his pure progeny. In fact, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam is shedding light on Yawm al-Qiyamah, on the Day of Judgment, and on the importance of keeping that constantly fresh in our mind, to the extent that in order to be able to avoid the eternal torment of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you need that remembrance to be circulating and remaining fresh in your mindset, in your worldview, in your lifestyle, in your vision, on the basis of making decisions. In this part, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam says, someone who is, in fact, uses a powerful metaphor, he's saying choosing worldly comfort over avoiding eternal torment is an irreparable loss. It then contrasts the dynamic and unstable nature of the material world, where everything is in motion, like electrons, which the absolute stability and cessation of movement in the takes place in the afterlife. And the afterlife is depicted as the ultimate anchorage where all physical laws and calculations cease to apply. This profound concept is linked to the Quranic verse that it says, وَإِلَىٰ رَبِّكَ الْمُنْتَهَىٰ. And from Surah An-Najm, verse 42 of the 53rd surah of the Holy Quran, which means verily to your Lord is the ultimate return. Everything returns to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Imagine if someone keeps that alive and fresh in their mind. What happens? Every decision that you make, every little tiny step that you take, every little thought that passes through your mind will go through a control system. And that control system makes sure that whatever thought, whatever deed, whatever decision that you make is something that is admittable or acceptable for that day that you go to return to Allah the Almighty. Let's take a quick break, and inshallah, we'll be back quickly.
Oh,
You are listening to the program Bridge on Iran Radio.
Our respected brothers and sisters, what I want to emphasize on is that Qiyamah cannot be conceived. And since we live in a world with proportions and do not have a correct understanding or a measurement of a system devoid of proportions, and all our senses and perceptions are accustomed of or to quantitative measures and calculations related to proportions, therefore the infallibles, the A'imma al-Ma'asumin alayhim as-salam, peace and blessings be upon them, speak to us. The Holy Quran also speak to us in a way that is tangible for us. If they make examples, right? If the verses are describing the heaven, for example, let's say, or the hell, for example, let's say, in a certain way, it's just for us to understand it. Would it be the exact reality? Would I see exactly whatever I have been described? No, it's much more than that. Amir al-Mu'minin, a beautiful hadith, says, in this, the hereafter is like this. Hearing about it, seeing it is greater than hearing about it. Because once you hear about it, once you read about it, it's limited to your depiction, right? It's limited to your power of imagination. Whereas when you see it, means that when you confront with it, when you're facing it in reality, once you pass through this transient life, then you see that the reality of the hereafter is much different. Over there, our worldly calculations are not applicable anymore. It's Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's system of calculation that rules over the Qiyamah, the hereafter. Inshallah, on that day we'll be victorious with the help and assistance from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program Bridge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mahdi, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را هرگز مخواد از کف دهم عشق و تولای تو را
Searching for the light, and you see no hope in sight. Be sure and have no doubt, He is always close to you. He's the one who knows you best, He knows what's in your heart. You'll find your peace at last if you just have faith in Him.
You're always in my heart and mind, your name is mentioned every day. You no matter what, my biggest wish is to see you.
Isfahan has long been a city of superlatives, once the dazzling capital of the Persian Empire. It has been praised in poetry, painted in manuscripts, and remembered by travelers as one of the most beautiful cities in the world. Its domes shimmer with turquoise and gold, its boulevards stretch beneath ancient plane trees, and its squares still thrum with the life of centuries past. For Iranians, Isfahan is not just a city, it is memory, identity, and pride. For visitors, it is a journey through time, a place where beauty is not hidden in museums, but lived in the streets. They call it Nisfe Jahan, which means half of the world, and here in Naqsh-e Jahan Square, you can see why. Once the heart of the Safavid Empire, this is where life, art, and history come together in one breathtaking panorama. Welcome to Isfahan, an ancient city that still captures the hearts of travelers from all around the world. Isfahan is Iran's third largest city, just 435 kilometers south of Tehran. But unlike the political capital, Isfahan has always been the spiritual and cultural heart of the country. From the 16th century, when Shah Abbas made it the capital of his empire, the city became a showcase of Persian brilliance, a center of science, trade, art, and architecture that drew visitors from Venice, Delhi, and even Beijing. Our introduction to Isfahan began with a meeting with Mr. Mehdi Jamalinejad, governor of the province. He painted a vivid picture of Isfahan's unique character, highlighting its blend of ancient heritage and modern achievements, from world-famous monuments to a state-of-the-art healthcare hub.
The province of Isfahan is one of the largest in Iran, with more than 114 cities, over 1,000 villages, and more than 22,000 historical sites. Its tangible and intangible heritage is truly unparalleled. Just recently, we lost the great master painter, Mahmud Farshtian, who was one of many symbolic figures rooted in this land. When the new administration came into office last year, we defined three main axes for development in Isfahan. The first of these, and one of the most important, is tourism. Our aim is to transform the province's enormous potential into real, active opportunities. Most foreign visitors know Isfahan only for its history and monuments, but our province also has extraordinary natural attractions, especially protected areas like Muteh, Qamishlu, and Kolah Qazi, which are ideal for ecotourism. Beyond cultural and historical tourism, we are also working on religious tourism, health tourism, and more. Isfahan Healthcare City is unique in Iran, and it already attracts visitors from abroad. Some of the doctors based there are internationally renowned.
Naqsh-e Jahan Square itself is a city within a city. Flanked by the Imam Mosque, the Sheikh Lutfullah Mosque, the Ali Ghafu Palace, and the Great Qaisariyye Bazaar, it is both a UNESCO World Heritage Site and one of the largest squares in the world. It is here that you understand why Isfahan has always been seen as a living museum of Persian civilization. Mr. Governor stressed that Isfahan's allure cannot be attributed to just one reason, but to a rich combination of elements.
استان اصفهان بی‌نظیر از جهت جاذبه‌های گردشگری.
Isfahan's uniqueness also lies in its biodiversity. Certain species of wildlife and fish exist here and nowhere else in the world. This too is an attraction for visitors interested in nature. On a global level, Isfahan is twinned with major cities like Barcelona and St. Petersburg and is a member of many international networks, from UNESCO-created cities to organizations of historic capitals. This reflects Isfahan's global reputation, which is not new but centuries old. Travelers in past centuries described it as one of the most flourishing cities in the world.
Every tile here tells a story of patience, devotion, and a love for beauty that defines Persian architecture. Isfahan's mosques aren't just monuments, they're living museums of color, geometry, and light. This artistry isn't locked in the past, it continues to inspire architects and visitors alike, making Isfahan a treasure for those who come seeking meaning and beauty. Beyond the mosques and palaces, the city's cultural richness is unmatched. Siyosepol and Khaju Bridge stretch across what was once the mighty Zayanda River, creating gathering places that are still alive today. The Chehel Sutun Palace dazzles with mirrored columns that reflect history as vividly as the day they were built. And in Julfa, the Armenian quarter, cobblestone streets lead to Vanq Cathedral, a reminder that Isfahan was always a crossroads of faiths and cultures. Conversations continued with Mr. Amir Karamzadeh, Director General of Isfahan's Cultural Heritage, Tourism, and Handicrafts Organization. He emphasized that despite its fame, much of the province's tourism potential has yet to be realized.
ما در اصفهان زیبا خیلی خیلی میتونیم بیشتر رو حوزه گردشگری تمرکز کنیم.
Isfahan truly deserves much more focus on tourism. We believe that if tourism thrives here, it will benefit the whole country, because visitors who come to Isfahan often go on to explore other parts of Iran. Handicrafts play a complementary role in this. Isfahan is home to one-third of the world's handicraft disciplines. You could fairly call it the handicrafts capital of the world. This is thanks to our rich heritage and the outstanding artists who have worked here. One example is the late Master Mahmoud Farshchian, an internationally renowned painter of miniatures, who was from Isfahan. The city is also the resting place of many great mystics and spiritual figures. For instance, Taht-e-Fulat, our historic cemetery, has significant potential for religious tourism.
Step into Isfahan's bazaar and you step into centuries of tradition. Here, the artisans craft minakari enamel, weave Persian carpets, and carve intricate marquetry, which are all skills passed through generations. This isn't just shopping, it's conversation with history, and where every purchase is a piece of Persian culture that you can take home.
Another distinction is that Isfahan is a UNESCO creative city for handicrafts, one of very few worldwide. More than three-quarters of Iran's handicraft disciplines are concentrated here. In some villages, every single household is a small workshop. Entire families produce crafts together. Handicrafts here are not hobbies, but livelihoods, deeply tied to culture and community. This is part of what makes them so attractive to visitors.
Handicrafts aren't just souvenirs here. They are part of the city's economic engine. Isfahan produces nearly a third of Iran's handicrafts exports, and its artisans are world-renowned. Another highlight of our visit was a conversation with Mr. Mohammad Natiqpour, president of the Isfahan Association of Handicrafts Exporters and Producers.
Isfahan is Iran's capital of handicrafts, and globally, it rivals countries like China and India. About one-third of the world's handicrafts are produced in Isfahan, while Iran as a whole boasts around 400 artistic disciplines.
For investors, the potential is enormous. Cultural branding, artisan villages, and international exhibitions could transform these crafts into premium global brands. Himself a celebrated marquetry master for more than 60 years, Mr. Natehpour shared how Isfahani artisans have contributed to the city's attraction.
Most of these art forms are also major tourist attractions. For example, khatamkari or marquetry, the most intricate and technical handicraft, is followed by metal engraving, wood inlay, carpet weaving, and others. Their colors and designs appeal differently across the markets. Carpets and larger works are popular in Europe and America, while neighboring countries often prefer smaller pieces. In short, the whole city of Isfahan can be considered a living museum of handicrafts with world-class masters working here.
In Natehpour's words, art is immune from the blades of sanctions and therefore represents a resilient and attractive sector for investment in Iran.
We face no real barriers to exports, even under sanctions. Neighboring countries such as Qatar, Oman, and UAE are key markets, as are Russia and China. We understand these markets' preferences and can successfully export to them.
Tourism already contributes close to 10% of Iran's GDP, and Isfahan is at its core. The province boasts more than 20,000 historical sites, over 60% of them concentrated right here in the city. But while millions of domestic visitors and thousands of foreign tourists arrive each year, the city still lacks the infrastructure to host them comfortably. Our visit took us to the Piruzi Hotel, where we met its manager, Mr. Amir Masoud Labbafan.
Isfahan is known worldwide as a museum city. Hotel services have improved significantly in recent years. Today, we have 5 5-star hotels in operation or nearing completion, several new 4-star hotels, and many boutique and traditional hotels. By 2026, with the addition of 4 more hotels, Isfahan's accommodation capacity will improve even further.
Mr. Labbafan emphasized that the hospitality industry offers one of the most profitable opportunities for foreign investors in Isfahan.
Many 1-2-3-star hotels exist, but many are aging and in need of renovation. Providing financial support to owners for refurbishment may be more effective than building new hotels. Around 30-40% of Isfahan's hotels require modernization, and renewing them would greatly strengthen the city's hospitality sector.
Consider this. Isfahan has only 2 5-star hotels. For a destination often compared to Rome or Istanbul, that is a major gap, and for investors, a major opportunity. Authorities here know it. To encourage development, Isfahan's municipality covers 99% of hotel construction permit fees, leaving investors to pay just 1%. Tax breaks, prime land, and fast-track approvals are on the table. In a region where tourism demand is outpacing supply, Isfahan is rolling out the welcome mat for those ready to build.
We have prepared about 110 investment packages. These are fully documented in a 3-language investment book, Persian, English, and Arabic. In addition, we operate a website where individuals and local authorities, municipalities, governorates can upload their own tourism investment opportunities. For example, if someone owns a piece of land and believes it has potential for tourism development, they can list it on this platform. Our aim is to create what we call investment wallets or ready-made packages, projects that already have the necessary permits and clearances, so that an investor can, quite literally, start work the very next day.
Thank you.
centuries, the Zayanda River has been the lifeline of Isfahan, flowing beneath these arches and bringing life to the city. Today, the water may not always run, but the bridges remain as places where people still talk, gather, and share their stories. The Khaju Bridge, with its magnificent and functional design, continues to echo with music, poetry, and laughter, proving that even without the river's flow, the spirit of Isfahan's community endures.
One of our main priorities now is developing designated tourism areas. Thanks to recent reforms in the statutes of the national water organizations, we can now make better use of rivers, lakes, and reservoirs for tourism. The Zayanda Root River's banks, as well as our many dams, can serve as attractive sites. We are promoting different forms of nature tourism, ecotourism, mountain tourism, and desert tourism. Isfahan's deserts, Khur and Biabanak, Maranjab, Aran and Bidgul, Varzane, and even parts of Nain, are among the most pristine in Iran. They are ideal for stargazing in dark sky zones, where within 30 to 50 kilometers, there is no artificial light, a feature highly valued worldwide for astronomy tourism. Beyond nature, Isfahan is world famous for its historic monuments, especially those from the Seljuk, Ilkhanid, and Safavid eras. Their unique architecture and ornamentation are treasures of Iranian art that attract countless visitors. Many of these sites, including our numerous caravanserais, offer investment opportunities for restoration and adaptive reuse. All of these have been compiled into our investment guide.
This ability to transform challenges into attractions is part of Isfahan's story. The dry riverbed has sparked creative ideas, festivals, cultural nights, and light shows that turn absence into presence. And beyond the city center, ecotourism is taking shape. Salt caves in Natanz, the slopes of Sofim Mountain, and gardens that bloom in the desert are opening new chapters in Isfahan's tourism playbook.
I often say that although Isfahan has not been Iran's capital for more than 400 years, the city still behaves as if it were. In development projects, whether social, cultural, economic, or infrastructural, Isfahan carries itself with the dignity of a capital city. Each of our cities is like an open-air museum. From Kashan to Niyasar, from Qamsar to Abiyaneh, and further into the deserts and mountains, every part of this province has something unique to offer. Our deserts, like Khur and Biabanak, are breathtaking, while mountainous regions, like Semirom and Feridun Shahr, are equally beautiful. In northern areas, you can find historical cities whose architecture reflects centuries of different styles, like a living atlas of Iranian design. Yet, unfortunately, most tourists, even domestic ones, only visit the well-known landmarks such as Siyosepol, Khaju Bridge, or Naqsh-e-Jahan Square. They remain unaware of the hidden treasures scattered across the province.
Health tourism is another frontier. With modern hospitals, internationally trained doctors, and costs a fraction of Europe, Isfahan is attracting patients from Iraq, Afghanistan, the Persian Gulf countries, and beyond. To learn more about Isfahan Healthcare City, we met with its operations manager, Mr. Reza Heybati.
Isfahan has deep roots in medicine and healing, stretching back centuries. Even Avicenna had a school here, and institutions such as the Nizamiya attracted students and patients from across the world. This legacy forms both a scientific and cultural foundation for health tourism today. Building on this tradition, modern Isfahan is home to highly skilled physicians and advanced medical facilities. From traditional medicine to cutting-edge treatments, the city offers a wide spectrum of healthcare. If we can better introduce these strengths to the world, Isfahan can become a leading international destination for health tourism.
Treatment packages now combine surgery with cultural chores, recovery with discovery. For investors in clinics, wellness resorts, or medical hospitality, the potential is immense.
Based on our studies and with strong support from national authorities, we have planned to establish a special health zone in Isfahan. Healthcare City is its first phase. The legal framework for such zones provides exceptional advantages, reduced bureaucracy, simplified processes for investors, and easier import of medical equipment. This means that projects can move forward faster and with fewer administrative obstacles. In Healthcare City itself, Phase 1, Phase 2, and its surrounding area, we are already developing these opportunities. It's becoming both an economic driver and a magnet for investment. The results will not only create economic value, but also raise the level of individual and public health. Improved health is the foundation of development. It enables a society to advance socially and economically.
Mr. Heybati explained why patients from across the region and beyond choose this modern medical hub.
Many countries in our region impose restrictions on certain treatments. For example, gender selection may be prohibited. Fertility and infertility treatments may be underdeveloped, or cosmetic surgeries may not be widely available. In Iran, by contrast, our doctors perform these procedures routinely and at a high standard. This makes Isfahan particularly attractive for patients from abroad. At the same time, it creates income for the city and helps elevate our physicians from local to international standing.
Religious tourism also remains underdeveloped. The province counts more than 700 shrines, 100 historic mosques, and churches that date back centuries. In a world where pilgrim travel is a multi-billion dollar industry, Isfahan could be a hub if the right accommodations and services are built.
One of the most important investment areas in Isfahan is our historic buildings. The province is extremely rich in monuments and old structures, both privately and publicly owned. We're trying to support and incentivize their restoration and reuse. Together with municipalities and city councils, we have worked to simplify procedures, for example, permits for establishing tourism facilities or exemptions and reductions in land use conversion fees. Under the 7th National Development Plan, many of these fees have been reduced to zero, which is a powerful incentive. That plan also provides other supports for tourism, such as allowing duty-free import of tourism vehicles.
But perhaps the greatest investment opportunity lies in preservation. Many of the city's monuments, some truly one of a kind, are in urgent need of restoration. Across the world, from Florence to Kyoto, public-private partnerships have turned heritage preservation into both cultural duty and profitable venture. Isfahan is no different. With smart investment, saving history can become a sustainable business. When discussing Isfahan's future, Mr. Karamzadeh stressed that the province's greatest opportunities no longer lie in heavy industry, but in areas that both honor heritage and safeguard the environment.
Another area of development is roadside service complexes. Isfahan is one of Iran's main transport crossroads, so facilities along highways are in high demand. Beyond the 110 investment packages I mentioned, we have identified another 60 to 70 opportunities, specifically in this sector. We firmly believe that the province no longer needs to expand heavy industry. Isfahan is already industrialized enough, and further growth in this direction would harm the environment and water resources. Instead, we must pivot toward tourism and clean industries, sectors that protect the environment, conserve natural resources, and require far less water. Tourism in particular is not water intensive, and it can gradually replace some of the province's water-hungry industries. Our hope is to make tourism the leading sector in Isfahan's economy.
here along Charbagh, where plane trees cast their shadows and centuries-old buildings line the way, Isfahan's story unfolds with every step. Wherever your journey begins, let it bring you here to walk these boulevards, share in its flavors, meet its people, and see for yourself why Isfahan is called half of the world. For the traveler, Isfahan is a place to marvel. For the investor, it is a place to act. Few cities combine heritage this rich with a market this open. With millions already coming each year and global recognition growing, the moment to shape Isfahan's tourism future is now. Isfahan, half the world and a whole opportunity.
من فکر می‌کنم که علی‌رغم تبلیغات اشتباه و
Despite negative portrayals in some foreign media, Iran is in fact one of the fastest countries for foreign investment. The Islamic Republic offers strong guarantees that are hard to find elsewhere. In addition, Iran is rich in human capital, highly educated professionals, united by a shared culture and strong traditions, working together. Perhaps the strongest assurance is that the country's highest leadership explicitly prioritizes investment and production. When the leader of the revolution designates investment and production as the national theme of the year, it becomes a guiding policy for all institutions. This level of political commitment offers unparalleled confidence to investors.
Thank you for joining us on this journey. Until next time, take care.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio broadcast from Tehran. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. In Islam, the ink of the scholar is more holy than the blood of the martyr. There are an estimated 1.8 billion Muslims in the world, which is about 1.5% of the world's population. Due to the birth and conversion rates, Islam is considered to be the fastest growing religion in the world today. We start off this hour's programs with A to Z of Life. This program presents an Islamic Iranian lifestyle in a variety of ways, making use of the ayahs of the Holy Quran, as well as inspirational poetry and stories. Next up will be our radio productions feature. They will be followed by The Key. The program presents short answers to doubts and ambiguities raised about various Islamic and Shiite topics. Our varied radio productions feature will round up this hour's programs. Stay with us for this hour.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, sincerity versus nepotism. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, welcome to A to Z here on IRIB English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And obviously, look, this topic is, in a sense, it's always current wherever we are in the world. And you would maybe think that, if someone's talking about nepotism, this must be about the senior levels in politics or in government. And actually, not necessarily so. And I'm pretty sure that every single one of us, if I give an example from my own life, would be able to sort of pinpoint maybe several instances in their lives where they've maybe observed or been aware or just been told about some instances of nepotism. So nepotism is obviously this sort of sense that we try to get extra benefits or privileges through sort of knowing someone else. And, you know, to some extent, you know, if we're looking for a job or someone we know is looking for a job, then for sure, you know, there's the idea of networking. And so we might, if a friend of ours is looking for a job and we maybe know someone else who works in that field, we might say, oh, okay, well, look, send your CV to so-and-so and I'll speak to them. You know, and that is maybe, that's totally normal in terms of networking. But what I'm actually talking about is, for example, if there are specific rules where, you know, we're not supposed to be benefiting from our family ties. And look, I'll give, first of all, I'll give a little example from my life, and then I'll talk about some of the maybe more sort of, let's say, official examples in life. So, for example, I was once, I was a chairperson in one organization, in a childcare organization. And then someone approached me and said, oh, because I'm the chairperson, can I sort of bump their name up in that organization so that they get childcare very quickly? And I thought, well, this is totally against the rules. And yeah, I was very surprised. So think about it. Have you actually come across examples such as that where people, through knowing someone in an organization, are trying to get privileges ahead of others or sort of be bumped up the queue? Welcome back to A to Z here on I'm Being English Radio, me sister Zainab. And so obviously I'm talking about this idea of nepotism and getting special privileges. And obviously against that is the idea of sincerity.